What are you studying today in the class? All the initial verses which have translations describing Dhyan Yoga, but the purports are all different. In the sense that sometimes it appears that Prabhupada gives a different purport altogether. So, is it, this is correct understanding?
Give an example.
Krishna says, you do this, go to a sacred place, select a position which is not too high, not too low, and keep your body erect, concentrate your mind on the tip of the nose, and then you have Prabhupada's purports which say that this is not at all possible, and it may be for some material profit, but Krishna consciousness is the easiest. Like, one after another, all the purports seem to be like that, in that direction. So, is that what Prabhupada wants us to understand? That this is completely impractical and we should just like never think of...
Cite an example with the book.
Sacred place refers to places of pilgrimage. In India, the yogis, the transcendentalists and the devotees all leave home and reside in sacred places such as Prayag, Mathura, Vrindavan, Rishikesh and Haridwar. And in solitude practice yoga, where the sacred rivers like Yamuna and the Ganges flow. But often this is not possible, especially for Westerners. The so-called yoga societies in big cities may be successful in earning material benefit, but they are not at all suitable for the actual practice of yoga. One who is not self-controlled and whose mind is not undisturbed cannot practice meditation. Therefore, in the Brihadaranyaka Puran, it is said that in Kali Yuga, the present yuga or age, when people are in general are short-lived, slow in spiritual realization and always disturbed by various anxieties, the best means of spiritual realization is chanting the holy name of the Lord. Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nameva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva, Nasteva, Nasteva Gatiran. In this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the only means of deliverance is chanting the holy name of the Lord. There is no other way, there is no other way.
Also, I have one more, page 317. It's the translation of the 10th verse. The translation reads that a transcendentalist should always engage his body, mind and self in relationship with the Supreme. He should live alone in a secluded place and should always carefully control his mind. He should be free from desires and feelings of possessiveness. But the purport begins with realizing Krishna in three degrees of Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan. So, devotees were discussing as to how it relates to the verse exactly.
But bringing every verse of Gita, explaining it in relationship to the conclusion of the Gita. He's not, in these two verses that you have presented, Srila Prabhupada is in no way contradicting what the verse says. It relates because Krishna is saying a transcendentalist should always gauge his body, mind, and self in relationship with the Supreme. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada is describing what is the nature of the Supreme and how the various processes. Nevertheless, all of these are instructed herewith to be constantly engaged in their particular pursuits so that they may come to the highest perfection sooner or later. Krishna is explaining various means of approaching the Supreme. However, Krishna's own conclusion in the Gita and throughout the Gita is that he is the Supreme. And that the only way to achieve him is through bhakti. So Srila Prabhupada is, and Baladev Vidyabhushan and the other great acharyas who have commented on Bhagavad Gita are trying to bring us to that highest perfectional stage. This chapter ends with Yoginam Api Sarvesham Madhyate Nantaratmana. Of all yogis, one who abides in me with great faith and devotion, he is the highest. So the great acharyas, they are keeping the focus of every verse on the purpose and the goal of that verse, which is to ultimately bring us to the point of surrendering to Krishna. Sarva-dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. Krishna says, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. And how to surrender to him? Man mana vidamaj bhakto, to always think of him. That is the conclusion of Gita. To understand Krishna the Supreme and to surrender to him in devotion. So the acharyas are so merciful. They are explaining every particular verse in relationship to the ultimate goal of the Gita. In this particular chapter, Krishna is explaining Jnana Yoga, but Arjuna himself says it's impossible for him to perform. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada explains it to each verse in the purport how, in practical terms, this is to be applied to our life. And therefore it is practical. Otherwise, who could possibly follow these principles that are in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Do you know anyone? There may be perhaps a few very great yogis with samskaras of previous lives who may be able to even reasonably attempt this process. But Arjuna says it's impossible for him to do. And Krishna concludes this chapter by exalting the process of bhakti. So dhyani, the perfection of dhyana, is to always meditate on Krishna. And this is what Srila Prabhupada is giving us. He's giving us the essence, the conclusion, the fulfillment of the entire Gita in every purport. This is consistent to Vishwanath Chakravarti, Baladev Vidyabhushan, Bhakti Siddhanta, the six Goswamis. This is the way they would comment on every shloka of every Veda, to bring the conclusion, to connect it to the conclusion. Prabhupada explains every verse on the content of the verse, but in every time he brings it to its conclusion in relationship, surrender to Krishna. Does that answer your question? You cannot realize the Absolute Truth without practicing the teachings of the scriptures. That practice is only possible when we understand the scriptures through a proper spiritual master. So Krishna explains how you should keep your body erect and your mind totally fixed in me. This is what essentially he's saying in the sixth chapter. You have to keep your mind unwavering, fixed in meditation on me, with no thought of sex desire, with no thought of possessiveness, proprietorship. Is that what Krishna is saying in the sixth chapter? But what is the ultimate object of meditation? Me. Me means Krishna. So, since the Astanga process is impossible for practically anyone to follow, Srila Prabhupada is explaining how to keep your consciousness always on Krishna. You cannot sit in a secluded place without eating, without any desires, without any feeling of possessiveness, in a stage of conditioned consciousness. But we can fix our consciousness completely on Krishna through chanting the holy names of the Lord. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught us the perfection of dhyana is to always fix your mind on Krishna, and this is the practical means by which everyone and anyone can fix their mind on Krishna. Prabhupada brings it to the practical conclusion that we can follow in our life. Otherwise, we find so many very famous lecturers of Bhagavad Gita. Everything is theoretical. In their own lives, it's theoretical. What to speak of their students? By hearing from these big Arthasarathis and Chinmayanandas, and how many people's lives are really changing to be compassionate, to be merciful, to be pure, to be giving everything to Krishna, to be surrendering everything to Krishna, to be always thinking of Krishna. They don't even teach that. They will teach all these technical data about dhyan, but they'll completely miss the conclusion. Correct? And the devotees, they will go right to the conclusion and stick only to the conclusion. And they'll explain everything in reference to the conclusion. That is their mercy. And they will change people's hearts. Change the quality of people's lives. If you hear, if anyone who's preaching on Gita, all of these big lecturers, they will scholarly, in such a scholarly way, with so many various profound, deep explanations, allegories, symbolisms, they'll explain all these technical details which Krishna tells us to all give up at the end. Give it all up and surrender to me. They'll elaborate on all the details Krishna tells us to give up, but they'll not say anything about what Krishna wants us to ultimately do. Does that answer your question? So Srila Prabhupada is writing Gita in a practical way for people of the world. And he knows that so many of these other interpreters are explaining all of these different points so much according to their own idea that God is impersonal, that ultimate silent meditation is the way to to merge into the impersonal supreme. That's what everyone is commenting these verses to me. So Srila Prabhupada is commenting on it in such a way that there's not a question of a doubt that ultimately what Krishna is saying when he talks about meditating on me is the personality of God and through bhakti. That is the constant theme of the Gita.
Hare Krishna.
Some scholars, they do not like Prabhupada's translation, because Prabhupada's translations, sometimes in his purports, he explains things in terms of bhakti where there's nothing specifically and directly said about bhakti in that verse according to the Sanskrit language. But Srila Prabhupada is bringing us to the practical conclusion in every verse. He doesn't want us to become caught up by the flowery words of the Vedas. He does not want us to be caught up by... He doesn't want any verse to distract us from the goal that Krishna is ultimately bringing us to. And that is his mercy. Hare Krishna. Any other questions? So he created the four varnas in the fire ashram. And brahmachari means no sex life. Krishna explains the necessity of celibacy. And ultimately, all of these transcendental slokas are bringing one to the platform of bhakti. Everything within the Gita is meant to bring you to the point of surrendering to Krishna and always thinking of Krishna. Krishna explains the four varnas and the four ashrams. Does not Krishna tell us to give up sense gratification in the Gita? Is not sex life sense gratification? It's the ultimate sense gratification. Krishna tells us to give up all sense gratification. Kama esha krodha esha rajo guna shamudbhava mahashano mahapapma vijina mihavaya. Dr. Gopinath Prabhu quoted this verse this morning in his Srimad Bhagavatam class, that lust is the greatest enemy. It leads to anger, leads to fall down. What is lust? There are three gates leading to hell, lust, anger, and greed, and every sane man should give them up, for they lead to the degradation of the soul. Trivedam nirakshayam varam nashitam atmanam. What is sex life? Is it anything less than kama or lust? It leads to the degradation of the soul, and every sane man should give it up. Now, according to the four varnas and four ashrams, we give it up in a particular way. For a grihastha, giving it up means to only do it for children. That is celibacy. To have sex for children is celibacy in the grihastha ashram. Brahmachari, sannyas, and vanapras, there's no question of touching the opposite sex for any purpose. Does that answer your question? question.
Dhruva Maharaj and Dhritarashtra, they also perform Jnana Yoga. So, and there are, can you give another example who have achieved the perfection of Jnana Yoga?
Dhruva Maharaj performed Bhakti Yoga. We all perform Jnana. When you're meditating on the holy name, that is Jnana, is it not? But it is in Bhakti. So similarly, Dhruva Maharaj, he was simply following Bhakti. Narada Muni taught him how to worship the deity on the bank of the Jamuna, how to live in the holy place at Vrindavan, Madhuban. He taught him how to always to serve the deity with great devotion. And he taught him how to completely fix one's consciousness totally on the form of Vishnu. That is bhakti. The perfection of jnana. And Dhritarashtra, he may have performed practice of jnana, but he did it under the guidance of a pure bhakta, Vidura. And thus, he achieved liberation. But because he was in the association of such a great bhakta, he received Krishna's special mercy. He was actually following the guidance of a pure devotee. That was his virtue. That was his glory. That was his saving grace. Because of his so many aparads, he couldn't meditate directly on Krishna. He made too many aparads to Vaishnavas. But Vidura was so expert, he taught him a process by which he can free himself from all his sins. And because he did it under the guidance of a devotee, an expert devotee, who knew exactly how to train him according to his sinful condition, he received Krishna's mercy. But we find both Dhritarashtra and Dhruva both performed their meditation and their devotional service under the guidance of bona fide spiritual masters who were both pure Vaishnavas, Mahajans. Both are Mahajans, Narada Muni and Yamaraj, in the form of Vidura.
Maharaj, we understand Bhakti Yoga, the essence of Bhakti Yoga, to be fixing the mind on the lotus feet of Krishna. Now, sometimes in the purports, the Bhagavad Gita, especially in the 5th chapter, Karma Yoga is described as action which is dovetailed to the service of Krishna. And even a Bhakti Yoga may be performing activities as an offering for the pleasure of Krishna. So, we understand the essence is there, but just for the purpose of technicality I am asking, what is technically Karma Yoga? Is it the same as action in Krishna consciousness? And what is Karma Mishrit Bhakti and what is pure devotion in terms of definitions?
Karma Yoga is action in Krishna consciousness. It's devotional service. Acting in the service of Krishna. Karma Mishra, that means someone who's mixed by the karma kanda. In other words, he's performing bhakti, but his motivation is material sense gratification. It's mixed with the desire for sense gratification. Karma Mishra Bhakta means that you're performing devotional service. However, your desire is mixed with the desire for fruitive results and material sense enjoyment. And Jnana Mishra Bhakti means your devotional service is mixed with the propensity of mental speculation or desire for liberation. Shuddha Bhakti means Anya Bilashita Sunyam Jnana Kamani Navratam. No trace of jnana or karma, simply the desire to please Krishna, the aspiration to please Krishna as the ultimate goal of your life.
If somebody is practicing karma yoga, which is action and devotional service, what is the difference between that and bhakti yoga per se?
According to the definition of the Gita, bhakti is actually the purest, highest state. When Krishna talks about bhakti, he's talking about pure, unalloyed, unadulterated devotion. He's talking about surrender. Now, since that is our goal, that is our ultimate aspiration, and we are following the principles that lead to that, that is bhakti yoga. When Krishna describes, or the karma yoga action in Krishna consciousness, it is more or less the same, but just a lesser realization. It is a lesser level of achievement of the supreme path of bhakti.
My question is regarding reading of Srila Prabhupada's books. So, is it necessary that a devotee has to first go through the Bhagavad Gita, then he should start reading Srimad Bhagavatam, and then after having completed Srimad Bhagavatam, he should start reading Chaitanya Charitamrita? Is there any sequential order, or is it an essential requirement that this order has to be stick to?
Srila Prabhupada never instructed us in any particular order. However, Srila Prabhupada did say that Bhagavad Gita was the beginning lessons of Krishna consciousness. Srimad Bhagavatam was the graduate study of Gita, and Chaitanya Charitamrita was postgraduate study of Bhagavatam. But he never said that we have to complete one before beginning another, because his purports include all previous teachings that he has given. Whether we read Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita or Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada's purports are always on the basis of the fundamental teachings of the Gita, so that we can understand it in proper perspective, even if we read these books directly. Srila Prabhupada, I have not heard that he has put any restriction. In fact, when he came to the West, he was giving everyone Srimad Bhagavatam. He didn't have a Gita. He was selling the world Srimad Bhagavatam. He didn't say, keep this, but don't read it until after I translate Gita. Then you can read. He said, you read it, you will become liberated. You will attain pure bhakti. It was only some years after he was distributing Bhagavats that he translated the Gita. And for the book distributors, they were distributing all simultaneously. In fact, when Antyalila of Chaitanya Charitamrita came out, he had the book distributors out in the airports distributing them directly to people who never even saw a devotee before in their life. Because his purports bring the conclusions so nicely to people's hearts. In that way, we don't say there's a restriction, but there is a general order in which it is advised to study Srila Prabhupada's books.
Hare Krishna.
Connected to Madhvacharya Prabhu's question, Maharaj, regarding our practical behavior, like some brahmacharis they act fanatically and some they act very loosely. So how do we balance when we are dealing with opposite sex, when we have to do some service? What should be ideal behavior? How should we behave?
Ideal behavior?
Yeah. Regarding dealing with opposite sex.
We should be respectful. We should not make offenses to them. However, we should not deal with them beyond what is required for our particular service. We should maintain formal. But if you neglect, then that is aparad to Vaishnava. I see this in our temple often. I have seen in the past where there's 15 Matajis and 25 men, and Brahma Samhita comes, and there may be, how many pages are there that you have? Maybe 50? Anyways, the devotees give one copy of Brahma Samhita to every man in the temple. There might be 10 left in their hand, and they'll just come back and put it on the table. And the ladies, most of them guests, are just sitting there. That is Vaishnava aparad. If a brahmachari says, well, they're Matajis, I cannot. You can give them to some grihastha to give to the Matajis. But you can't just neglect. Giving seats to all men, no seats to the women. That's simply aparad. Ladies should get every bit as much as treatment and respect as men. If you don't, it's aparad. Doesn't mean you have to, you can give to a grihastha and say, please give these seats to the ladies. Or you can give to one of the ladies and say, please give this to the rest. You don't have to ask them all about their how they're doing in their studies or anything. Just give them the seats. And you should not neglect.
And Gopinath Prabhu and Sankirtan Prabhu are in charge of the Brahmacharis Japa. So they suggested that if we sit in circles, then we can easily monitor each other. But that was not properly done. So finally we came up with the idea that if we arrange the mats in circles, so nobody moves from there. And therefore, since you had suggested that Grihasthas who are coming for Japa, they can sit anywhere, for them there is no rule. But Brahmacharis should sit together and chant. So for that we kept the seats only near the Brahmacharis chanting area.
But Vaishnava etiquette, do we have to consider how it appears to others also? Like you're giving nice hospitality, cordial welcome of a nice seat to the brahmacharis and to nobody else. How does that look?
Yeah, it looks bad enough. People always misunderstood this. They thought this seat is only for those who are exalted or something like that. Gopinath Prabhu even announced that this is only as a utility purpose. It doesn't denote any kind of spiritual advancement or seniority.
But how many times are you going to announce that? Every person that comes in the temple? If you're going to give somebody a seat, you should give everyone a seat. And since the brahmacharis are the Saivites of this temple, it's their duty to honor and serve everyone that comes, especially to chant the holy name. I believe that beyond sitting in circles, even if we sat in squares or rectangles or triangles, it's a nice mood of service to give everyone a sitting place when they come to chant japa. It cultivates a nice mood of service, and for guests that come, whoever they may be, it makes them feel wanted. It makes them feel like they're being honored in a certain way. And we want them to feel like that when they come to our temple. And we want to feel like we are honoring them when they come to our temple. When we advised a few days ago that every single person should have seat, it had nothing to do with the circular formation. It had to do with an increase in the service of the devotees. That anyone who comes and is going to sit for 1.5 hours to chant japa together, they deserve the hospitality of a sitting place, a nice asana. It creates a very nice spirit. But no one should be neglected. If you neglect people, that will be very bad. And I think it's very nice if we continue like this. Everyone gets sitting place. How long does it take? It may take... Huh?
Some devotees, when I told this, I gave the suggestion that we should give. Some devotees said that means we have to miss one round of japa.
One round?
Yeah, because we have to pass around everyone the bag. Yeah, that's what
Shishastakam is being said at different places, we can keep 5-5.
That's what we are doing.
Hare Krishna.
I have a question in relation to the purport which you are reading today, Maharaj. Srila Prabhupada explains about the verse Vishya Vinivara Kanche Niraharasya Dehina Raso Virjam Raso Krishya Param Dishra Nivartate, that as one starts performing devotional service, he gains a higher taste, and thus there is no need for him to perform artificial austerities. Devotional service itself is so sweet that he can, you know, advance. At other places we also read that Prabhupada explaining that devotional service may appear to be very difficult in the beginning, whereas sense gratification is, it appears to be nectar in the beginning and it's poison in the end. So my question is, how to see that this principle of Param Dishta Nivartante is properly maintained in our lives when we come from a background where we indulge in so much of sense gratification, and then suddenly, all of a sudden, when we are trying to struggle with the senses in the mind, that Param Dishta Nivartante, that the higher taste is also maintained. Is it that a particular type of service should be given to a particular devotee?
At the beginning, you may not experience a higher taste. Tapasya means that we are performing our work guided by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Ultimately, we cannot continue to refrain from sense gratification unless we experience a higher taste. In the neophyte condition, the path of bhakti, we may not be in ecstatic love. We may even be more inclined towards sense gratification than the pleasures we're deriving from Krishna consciousness. But we are getting a sense of satisfaction through practicing Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada told devotees they should eat so much prasad when they first come, because they may not have such a taste for the holy name, but they do like prasad. They may like sex life better than prasad. However, there's enough satisfaction in prasad to keep them happy enough to go on with the process of bhakti. And nice kirtans. Kirtans are very joyful. So we require that. The soul requires satisfaction. But the purification of our heart comes through tapasya. At the beginning, we do not have a real taste for devotional activities, but we have a very real taste for sense gratification. So we must be tani saravani samyamyaya yukta asitamatpara. That means we must continue to restrain our senses from sense gratification. That must always be there in Krishna consciousness. And by fixing one's consciousness on Krishna, gradually we develop a higher taste. It's not that at the beginning you have the higher taste. Gradually that awakens through the process of purification. Parandrasvani Vartate means like that. As we become purified, we can experience the higher taste of Krishna consciousness. And then naturally we have no more desire for sense gratification. But at the beginning we have to fight like a warrior, we have to struggle, we have to do tapasya to purify ourselves to come to that point. But in the meanwhile, there is some higher taste in Krishna consciousness. We haven't realized how high it is, but we require that. It's higher from the spiritual point of view. It's not higher from our mind's point of view. In the neophyte state, sense gratification is a higher pleasure to our mind and senses than washing pots, would you say? However, from the spiritual point of view, washing pots is a much higher taste. But we don't realize it. We realize it to the degree we're purified by doing it. Watching television is probably a higher taste to a neophyte devotee's mind and senses than chanting japa. How many would agree to that? I wasn't expecting such a unanimous vote. However, we avoid watching television and we chant japa because it is a tapasya, because we understand from Guru Sadhu Shastra that spiritually this is a higher taste. And by performing this tapasya, gradually we become purified and we can experience the higher taste of that. And when we actually become pure and experience the higher taste of devotional service, hearing and chanting, then the desire for sense gratification becomes insignificant. But that is a lifetime work to experience that higher taste. In the meanwhile, we have to do tapasya. We have to restrain our senses and our mind. However, to keep people on the path and keep people enthused to go on with their tapasya, it is beneficial that a devotee is engaged according to one's propensity. Automatically means as you become purified. You automatically become purified if you follow the process correctly. Automatically means ultimately by Krishna's mercy. It doesn't happen. It's not happening because of what you're doing. It's happening because Krishna's pleased with what you're doing.
This is regarding the yoga ladder.
telling about karma, jnana, ashtanga and bhakti in these Gita courses which we conduct. I just mentioned, instead of karma yoga, I mentioned nishkama karma. Then I say jnana, then dhyana and then bhakti. And in nishkama karma, I just quote this. Third chapter, 20th verse. Mai sarvani karmani sanyasya adhyatma chetasa nirashi nirmama bhutva yudhyasa vigata jvara. That you, everything surrender unto me. Yukta asita, mai sarvani karmani sanyasya adhyatma chetasa. Knowing your constitutional position, nirashi vigata jvara. Without give up laziness and lethargy and fight. So there, I say, I just want to know whether his understanding is right. That I say that he is doing it, he is giving up the result, but his conception of the absolute is not clear. And next, in the process of jnana, he realizes, he wants to know whom he is offering to. Yajnatat karmana, he is doing, but they do not know whom they are offering to. In the process of jnana, they realize that he is beyond this material world. And through the Ashtanga they focus their mind on that Supreme Personality, and then when they engage in devotion service, that is bhakti. So is this understanding alright and presented? Because this ladder is presented.
Yes, Bhagavad Gita is progressive. As the chapters of Bhagavad Gita progress, the understanding and realization of Krishna also progresses. Chapter of Karma Yoga, from the point of view of devotional service, when Bhagavad Gita is being taught by a pure bhakta, then every chapter is describing bhakti. However, progressive stages of bhakti. It is only in the 18th chapter where the full-fledged conclusion of bhakti is revealed in Sarva Dharman Puritya and Man Mana Pavamar Bhakti. Now the acharyas teach every verse from that point of view. But literally, Krishna is progressively bringing his teachings to the culmination of total surrender and complete absorption in that spirit. So yes, it is a progressive. It is a matter of how it is being understood, in the sense that Srila Prabhupada explains. He doesn't explain the Gita so much in the progressive form of gradually understanding higher and higher and higher levels that bring us to pure bhakti. He's explaining every verse from that point of view, knowing that this is where it's leading you. Bahunam janmanamante jnanavamam papadjate vasudeva saravamiti samahatma sudurlabha. Now if you take this verse literally, the perfection of jnana is to understand Vasudeva, the all-pervading Supreme Lord, or Krishna. However, in the 18th chapter, it's a much higher understanding of knowledge of Krishna, in total surrender, in total remembrance, worship. So literally, the Gita is teaching it progressively, higher and higher stages, bringing us to the point of bhakti, pure bhakti. But the acharyas like Srila Prabhupada, who has taken his commentaries from the inspiration of Baladeva Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti, they are explaining every verse in relationship to the conclusion, practically. Does that answer your question? So yes, from a particular point of view, what you are explaining is correct. Yes? In Gita, karma, dhyana, jnana, it's all directed toward Krishna. It's all bhakti. Different levels or stages of bhakti progressing in the theoretical explanation that Krishna's given. But Bhagavad Gita is nothing but bhakti. As far as the various systems of Jnana Khanda, Karma Khanda, Asanga Khanda, they are like a ladder bringing one to higher platforms which culminate in bhakti. In Gita, Krishna is speaking from the very beginning of bhakti. Arjuna surrenders to Krishna before Krishna even begins talking. But it is a progressive stage which you may call ladder into higher and higher realms until it culminates in always remembering Krishna and surrendering to Krishna. Any other questions? Yes?
Says that it's higher to work in pure devotional service than to work according to your occupation and just renounce the fruits. So how do we understand that according to like the Daivi Varnashram, where we should work according to our occupation and Krishna consciousness?
Highest is to surrender to Krishna in pure devotion. However, if we're not on that platform, Krishna is telling us the means by which, according to the particular level of consciousness or advancement you're on, how to gradually come to that platform of pure devotional service. Daivi Varnashram is the path that leads to pure bhakti. Varnashram Dharma, in the sense of social development without bhakti, that is simply structure, social structure, which leads to piety and goodness. Daivi Varnashram, specifically, whatever one's propensity, whatever one's state of consciousness, however low or high it may be, it's on the path leading to pure unalloyed devotion. That means whatever particular set of consciousness we're on, we're chanting the holy names of Krishna. We're performing our duties under the guidance of a devotee of Krishna, and we're striving and struggling to offer the fruits of our actions to Krishna. Gradually that leads to pure devotional service. Daivi Varnashram is the process by which everyone is in the path back home, back to Godhead, whether they are Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishya, Shudras, Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprastha, or Sannyasis. Because it is done under the guidance of a proper spiritual master, and it is done in the spirit of devotion.
said about tapasya. So if you are sick, then also you should attend morning program.
If possible. We have to use our good intelligence also, how to best serve. We should not let Maya steal away our intelligence. And we should take spiritual guidance also. Yes, we should attend the morning program, even if we're sick. But if we find that it is causing us to become more sick, then with the blessings of Vaishnavas, it is a higher service to get well. Hare Krishna. Is that a good answer? Most important is honesty. We shouldn't say we're sick because we're tired. We shouldn't think we're sick because we're lazy. If we're sick, we should go to Mangalarti. But if our sickness is so much that going to Mangalarti is causing such an exhaustion that it's increasing our sickness, then it is our duty to get our health better. We should have blessings, and we should be very honest in our appraisal.
Vrindavan, Mahanidhi Maharaj just entered the temple hall and I happened to be there and I offered him obeisances in front of the deities. So immediately he sort of chastised me and told me that, don't you know what Prabhupada said, that you should not offer obeisances to anyone in front of the deities. So when the spiritual master comes in the temple hall and when the devotees are engaged,
where did he chastise you?
And he was telling me that, don't you know that...
Where did he chastise you?
In the temple hall.
It also says you're never supposed to chastise someone in front of them.
Stephen just mildly corrected me.
They are both in the same chapter of Nectar of the Devotees. Hare Krishna. Leaders of Radha Gopinath Temple have discussed this in the past. It is in Nectar of Devotion that it is an offense to offer obeisances to someone in front of the deities. It also says you're not supposed to chastise anyone in front of the deities. However, it also says you're not supposed to offer obeisances to the guru in front of the deities. But Prabhupada would accept guru puja. In fact, he's doing it every day, right in front of the deities. Srila Prabhupada explains certain rules and regulations are subordinate to others. And this is where spiritual master is required. You shouldn't offend someone in front of the deities. So within the culture of our society, if a guru comes in with his disciples, and it's the custom that people offer obeisances, if the guru comes in with the disciples and nobody offers obeisances to the guru, then all the disciples will be offended, will they not? So in my evaluation, unless there is a very strong guideline for our entire movement of how this should be done, it's better to bow down before the deities than offend Vaishnavas. You know, I understand? Because in most temples they don't follow. And Prabhupada never really stressed it. If Giriraj Maharaj and 10 of his disciples came into the temple and no one bowed down, what do you think they would think? They would think that you're all just puffed up rascals. Correct? Why they're not bowing down to our guru? Whereas if you bow down, everyone feels, oh, very nice, such humble devotees. There's a strong guideline throughout the whole society. No one should bow down to anyone in front of the deities, and no one will get offended if you don't bow down. But if it's not, then people will be offended. So it's better to bow down. Prabhupada considered this particular rule somewhat of a detail. He didn't put so much emphasis on it. He put more emphasis on honoring a Vaishnava than the detail of not of bowing down in front of the deity. There are very prominent rules and there are detailed rules. And in the presence of a prominent rule, the detailed rules may be neglected. Does that answer your question? It depends on the time, place, and circumstance in that sense. Certainly it's there and it is a rule. But if everyone is not conscious and aware of that, people will be offended. And that's offending Vaishnavas takes prominence over that.
Yes. It also said that if you see a sannyasi, and first time you should bow down, otherwise it will pass. So in support of this point that if the temple room is open, if a sannyasi comes, if you don't bow down, that is also an offense and you have to fast. So if you bow down, then you don't have to fast.
Krishnananda does not like to fast. He has philosophically protected himself on all sides. Scriptural injunctions.
It also says that if two Vaishnavas come, in one book it's explained by Narahari Chakravarti, that if two Vaishnavas come, if one is very exalted, the other is not so exalted, then we should not give equal respects. So what does that mean exactly in terms of?
Say again?
That if two Vaishnavas enter simultaneously, then one should not offer the same respect to each. There should be a distinction. So how is that enacted? Like some very exalted sannyasi.
That is in the sense of a very clear difference in a person's position. We should not try to minutely analyze if one is slightly more exalted than another, then treat them differently. If someone is very obviously of another category of within the Vaishnava line, then they should be respected according to their position. If a person is a sannyasi and he comes in the temple with a new bhakta, obviously you will give a particular type of respect to the sannyasi, but you will also give a particular type of respect to the bhakta. If you neglect the bhakta, that's aparad. But you will obviously give much more expression to your reception to the more exalted, to the person in a more exalted position. However, if a new bhakti comes in alone, you may not have a foot washing ceremony and offer arti and everything else, but you should offer him great, great respect and make him feel that he's very much honored. We should do that for everyone. But still, there's a way of honoring devotees according to their particular positions in Krishna consciousness, and that should be respected. If you treat a sannyasi who comes with 20 disciples as a new bhakta, that's an offense, is it not? So we should honor everyone according to the etiquette of the particular position that they hold. That's what it means. In Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, when one of the associates of Lord Nityananda Prabhu came to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami's brother's temple, the pujari just continued worshipping the deity, but did not stop his worship to offer respect to the Vaishnava. And because he did that, he fell down. He was so much absorbed in the particular rules and regulations of deity worship that he did not properly honor and receive a great Vaishnava. He fell down. And his brother defended his position, and he also fell down. So honoring Vaishnavas takes prominence. Avoiding aparads to Vaishnavas takes prominence. Yes.
Brahmachari class about chanting. That we every day we say that to be inattentive while chanting is also an offense. And we are also told that a devotee should always try to chant 24 hours whenever he's doing any service also. Suppose he's cleaning pots or he's doing something. So it's better to always keep chanting. Now if a devotee is not paying attention on his chanting and he's engrossed in his seva, so is that an offense to the holy name? This was his question. What is the best way of answering it?
During japa, during bhajan, during kirtan, we should put our full attention on chanting. During those times, to let your mind wander is offensive. If you're doing other services and you're singing or chanting, that should not be considered offensive.
Chanting, thinking of seva is also kind of deviation, but then during Mangalahuti, Brahma Samhita, other things, generally it becomes a planning session for the whole day. You are there.
In your mind, you mean?
Yeah.
During Mangalahuti?
Most of the time. Once in a week or once in maybe 10 days that you concentrate on the whole, every word of Mangalarti or Brahma Samhita. Brahma Samhita is more rarer. But that becomes a session where, even during Radha Madhava, it becomes more like a formality. How do we understand the importance of it?
We should put our concentration. Of course, if you're thinking of service, you're also thinking of Krishna. So we cannot say that is a bad thing. If you're thinking of sense gratification, that is a bad thing. If you're thinking of something mundane, that is a bad thing. If you're thinking of how to serve, that is a good thing. However, there is a time of the day to think of your service, and there's a time of the day that it is very, very essential to fix your mind on the deity form and the holy name. During the Mangalarti, we should be concentrating on the holy name, we should be concentrating on prayers to our Guru, and we should be concentrating on the form of the deity. We should try to put our full concentration on that. However, if our mind slips away to thinking of how to serve, that's all right. But we should bring it back to the name. If it slips away to sense gratification, that is a subtle fall down. But we should try to concentrate. We should try to perform the austerity of concentration. We have the whole day to make strategies for our service. During the morning program, we should keep our mind fixed purely on Krishna in the form of His name. That is the Yuga Dharma. All of our service throughout the day is ultimately meant to bring us to chanting purely. So that time when we're directly chanting, it's really the culmination of all the service we're doing. We should try to fully concentrate our minds simply on chanting, simply on this beautiful form of the deity during the arti. Mangal arti is a time of prayer. It shouldn't be a time of management. And with your good intelligence, you should guide your mind to concentrate. Hare Krishna. Yes.
Maharaj, can you please kindly explain about glorification of devotees? That we sometimes directly glorify devotee, and that we know that it's good for us, but we, in the same time, we know that it's not good for him. And maybe even if we feel that we don't like that, we still do glorification. What we should do in that kind of case?
It should be done sincerely. It should not be done as a joke. If we are sincerely showing our appreciation for a devotee, it is good for us. And at the same time, if that devotee is sincere, it will only make that person more humble. It will make that devotee feel appreciated. And if devotees do not feel appreciated, they will not stay in Krishna consciousness. If you're artificially just trying to puff someone up, that is harmful. But if you're trying to show appreciation for a person's efforts in Krishna consciousness, you're actually sustaining his spiritual life. Who would want to stay in a place where nobody appreciates anything they're doing? Maybe Judd Bharat. But most of our God brothers and God sisters are not on the platform of Judd Bharat. They require appreciation. We should give them appreciation. We should not artificially glorify to try to make them puffed up. But we should show appreciation for what they're doing. And that is proper glorification.
you don't have to go to Gauranga and say, you are more learned than Brihaspati. You are more beautiful than Kandarpa. You are stronger than Bhima. You are more advanced than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We don't have to say all flattering exaggerations. But we can show appreciation for the sincere effort of their devotional service. And that is, when devotees appreciate each other, it becomes Vaikuntha. To be done sincerely, in a mood of service. We shouldn't be saying it because we want to get something from the person later. Like Radha Gopinath Prabhu, you are such an exalted soul. You inspire my heart like no one ever has inspired me. The history of 8,400,000 births. But in your mind, you're thinking he's one of the presidents. If he likes me, then he will give me what I want. That type of glorification should not be done. But sincere appreciation for one's service, that should be expressed. And that type of glorification, we should always be eager to offer to all Vaishnavas. If you read Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, all the devotees are showing such appreciation for each other. It generates a mood of love. That is Vaishnava atmosphere. So, it is time to end. I have to go to another program just now. Have we discussed and improved on what we talked about last meeting? Washing clothes? We have not done anything. You are showing appreciation for the all of these things that the devotees brought up, these subjects are all important. You took notes of everything? Amongst the department heads and the presidents, you should meet together. Each one of them is very simple to execute. This takes attention. And we should actually have training courses on all these subjects, a certain particular schedule. Very nice. He is Govinda's senior brother. Who brought who to Krishna consciousness?
Whatever he is to us, he is to us.
I didn't ask you about smoking. Who brought who to Krishna consciousness? Direct question requires a direct answer. So you first learned about Krishna from Srinivas. Hard as it is to admit. Srinivas Prabhu ki! Hari Hari! Actually, to play mridanga, all you have to do is move your fingers. Does everyone have the strength to move their fingers? You may not be, you may not be able to go into a kirtan with the big leaguers of ISKCON who are beating away for hours at a time. But you can lead nice kirtan, just moving your fingers and playing mridanga according to your capacity. We're not concerned that every devotee is an expert. If you have the capacity, you can become expert. Otherwise, you should at least learn to be able to sing and play along with your own singing and lead a kirtan for others. And anyone can do that. You do not have to be big and strong. I know 85-year-old men sitting down playing mridanga and chanting. And we also want to make policies for the temple. It is very important. We want to compile a book with policies. And the presidents will be calling upon many other devotees to help to formulate these policies. Because without policies, we make the same mistake again and again. And that is a waste of our time, and it creates many aparads. Oftentimes, we make some mistake, and then we meet for hours, and we make a rule, and then 6 months later, everyone forgets the rule, and we do it again. And then we sit for hours, trying to decide what to do, and then in the end, we realize we already decided this. Correct? That's the way the management goes on? Sometimes. But if we have a book of the policies and we live by those policies, then we don't have to make mistakes again and again and use so much of our energy to try to solve a problem that's already been solved. Yes? When will you do?
I hope to have a book in print before you come for the master.
Rough draft should be within a few weeks. Your wonderful service. Forgive me for my useless condition of life. But by serving all of you,
there is hope even for the useless. Hare Krishna.